Welcome to this session on shopping vouchers. No, sorry, on the pandemic risk. I'm reliably informed that we're in this big room so that we can reduce the contagion risk. So if you feel you need to spread out further in the room, one of our speakers has brought along a sample virus for us all to try out if we so wish. No, that's a joke, of course. It gives me great pleasure to introduce two of my friends from Singapore. This is the Singapore session. Pierre and Jan are both experienced actuaries working at Aon in Singapore. Pierre is a graduate from the ESSEC Business School, and he's a French actuary, but we do like him nevertheless. Phew, I got away with that. That's all right. Pierre has lots of experience. You can read all about him on the website. I don't propose to go through and talk all through that. Jan is a fellow of the Australian Institute, the Institute of Actuaries of Australia, and also a fellow of the Singapore Actuarial Society. Why are you not a Singapore fellow, Pierre?
I think the French Actuarial Association is not recognised.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. We'll have to do something about that then. So both have been working in Asia for quite some time, and the topic of pandemic and I guess other maybe black swan type events, particularly relevant at the moment, a number of viruses being transmitted through different parts of the world. I thought the paper was also quite poignant given recent events, terrorist events in the sports occasion in the US. So I'm very interested to hear how our friends are going to deal with this topic. So without further ado, I'll pass over to Pierre.
Thank you, Andrew. Good afternoon, everybody. Maybe I should apologize in advance for my French accent. I'll try my best so that you can understand me properly. According to some of my Australian friends, not always the case. So we're here today to talk about pandemic risk, and is this really a black swan for life insurance companies? I must say first, it's dangerous risk. I mean, as we were working on this subject, Jan got progressively sick. I think she's done too much investigation, but don't panic. I think we're going to be all right. So let's have a quick look at our agenda. I mean, I'm sure you've all heard about pandemics, especially over the last few years. We heard about the bird flu, the swine flu. But the objective today is to give you a bit more maybe insight or in historical information and currently available sources on what is the pandemic risk, what is a pandemic, and can this be a black swan for the insurance industry. So then Jan will go through a few actual modeling techniques to look at this risk for insurance companies, and we'll conclude with what are the potential solutions to manage the financial impact of pandemic. So what is a pandemic? Let's look at the black swan, potentially. If we start from the beginning and definition of pandemic, so pandemic comes from pan, which means old in Greek, and demos, people. So basically a pandemic is an epidemic of infectious disease that will infect humans on a global scale. Obviously in this series there has been many example of pandemics of infectious disease, black plague in the Middle Age, smallpox, more recently HIV. But when we talk, or at least when we've been talking about pandemic over the last few years, we've heard things mainly about H1N1. So H1N1 is not the robot in Star Wars, it's a flu virus. So I mean, today, I mean, there's kind of a consensus, or it's globally admitted that for new future pandemic, the main threat would be coming from the influenza type of virus. In the history of influenza pandemic, again, depending on the sources, but there's been quite a few pandemic of influenza over the last centuries. 30 influenza pandemics over the last 500 years is one common number in many sources, so which means basically a flu pandemic would occur every 15 to 30 years. And if you look at just the last 20th century, there have been three major pandemics. I guess all of you have heard about the Spanish flu in 1918-1919. So this is really the major last one, and which killed more than 40 million people in the world at the time. So that was roughly 1% of the total population just after World War I. Other sources indicate could be up to 100 million people dying because of the Spanish flu at the time. If you look at just at Australia only, in a way, Australia was a bit preserved from that pandemic. I think early enough, the Australian government at the time had imposed strict quarantine on the maritime transport. So eventually, the Spanish flu reached Australia only in the early 1919. So clearly preserving population at the time from being as badly hit as other countries. So 10,000 lives, casualties in Australia at the time was 0.2% of the population, about 5 million at the time. And then in the 50s and 60s, there are two other pandemics, the Asian flu, 1957-59, and the Hong Kong flu in 1968-70. So both have claimed about 1 to 4 million lives. So they are not clearly as killing or as massive as the Spanish flu, but and I think they were mainly affecting Asian countries. We didn't find much evidence of higher than normal mortality rates in Australia at the time. But to give you a comparison, when you look at the seasonal flu, so every year, flu worldwide is affecting 5 to 15% of the total population and is killing about 250,000 to 500,000 people. So still, this Asian flu and Hong Kong flu, I mean, they had a global reach, and they were clearly abnormal mortality rates that were registered at the time. Here we've got some data, mortality rates per age band, coming from the US, and I hope you can see a bit the figures, but when you look at the seasonal flu, so again, the one recurring every year, and the pandemic, the Asian flu and the Hong Kong flu, clearly these pandemics are mainly dangerous for either young children or aged people, older people, or people with conditions. One of the main points of why a major pandemic could be a threat for the human population is that some viruses can be clearly more lethal, including for the 20 to 65 years old, so including for a population which is normally not subject to a severe condition in case of pandemic. And that was clearly the case of the 1918, which had mortality rates above 1% for the younger adults. So still talking about flu, influenza, scientists are mainly concerned about one particular type of influenza, which is the type A. There's three types, A, B, C, so the seasonal flu can be A, B, or C, but one of the main threats would come from the influenza A, which is recognized as being the most virulent and potentially causing the most severe diseases. And why we often refer to the potential pandemic as the bird flu is that wild birds are always the common denominator on a flu virus. So on the right, you can see all the different subtypes of the influenza A viruses. So that's all the potential combination between H1N1 or H1N2 and so on. Transmission of influenza A, I mean, it's not, again, I'm an actuary, I'm not an expert in medical, but the thing is, it's mutation of viruses is not something that people can predict or scientists can predict. So clearly, we've heard about bird flu, swine flu. The common denominator is always the bird on this type of influenza A, but clearly scientists are concerned about potential mutation and a mix of different flu viruses between a human flu virus mixing with a bird flu virus and a pig flu virus. But all these different combinations make it apparently very difficult to predict what are the chances of really having a new virus that can emerge. So is pandemic a black swan? So according to the World Health Organization, in order to have a new pandemic, there must be three conditions which must be met. The first one is having a new influenza virus that emerges. The second one would be that the virus can and does actually infect human people. And the last one being that the virus can transmit easily and in a sustainable manner from human to human. So obviously the two first conditions, a new virus that can affect human people, these things have happened quite recently. I mean, one of the main concerns from the scientists and the governments is the H5N1. It's been particularly watched since 2003. At that time we really heard a lot about the bird flu in Southeast Asia and other countries in the world. Because of the case fatality rates, I mean, people who got infected by the H5N1 clearly showed very high mortality rates. I mean, the case which have been tested so far shows mortality rate for people who are infected of closer to 60%, although this could be overestimated since many cases might not be tested. But so far, the H5N1 has not reached the last and third condition, which is it's not yet able to transmit easily from human to human. Although then scientists know that with a few mutations, this could potentially happen. More recently, we had the swine flu, 2009, 2010, H1N1 virus. So it was the same as the Spanish flu, same subtype. And this been declared a pandemic, actually, by the World Health Organization. I think at the start, again, we had the three conditions which had been met, new virus, virus infected humans, and it was being spread from human to human and reached global scale. I mean, the confirmed cases of the swine flu, so tested in laboratory, was 500,000 people and 18,000 deaths. But clearly, the World Health Organization declared the end of the pandemic mid-2010, and clearly I think there were initial fears that from the scientist community that the virus could be as potentially dangerous as the H1N1 from 1918, but luckily was not the case. And there's a few examples still going on of virus which are not very well understood or taken, for example, the H7 and 9, which is currently occurring in China. We don't know yet how this virus can evolve and if there is a chance or not that this can mutate and really affect human people much more dangerously. But is pandemic really a black swan? In a way, not really, because there is a clear consensus that a flu pandemic will happen, and it's not a matter of when, but it's not a matter of if, sorry, but when this will happen. And here nobody knows actually when this can happen. And maybe the black swan element of the pandemic is today we have no clue if there's a new pandemic happening, how contagious and how deadly or lethal the virus can be. And I would think compared to the expectations of the scientists or the insurance regulators, starting with APRA or in other jurisdictions, could be a black swan if we were clearly at a scenario which would be more deadly than the 1918 flu. And of course, there are factors which would tend to tell us today that we're not likely to have such a bad situation. I mean, obviously, there's been many improvements in terms of medical care. I mean, we do have now antibiotics, we have antiviral. The pharmaceutical industry is supposed to be able to produce vaccines. Still yet to know if they can be done in a sufficient time, but clearly we are much more well equipped than their global surveillance system. Each country, especially the developed countries and the countries in Asia, Southeast Asia, which are natural home of the appearance of new virus, have I've built preparedness plans since the H5N1 apparition in 2003. And I guess people are clearly in better shape than in 1918. On the other side, there could clearly we can intuitively see factors that would aggravate the situation compared to 1918. Think about the higher population density in the megacities, the faster and greater global air travel. So we're a bit in the dark, but we know for sure there is a concern here. So why is this a risk, and who should be afraid of that risk? Governments are first worldwide, and if we look at the Australian government in particular, the subject has been, I would say, taken seriously from an external point of view. So the Department of Health and Aging has issued a few papers. One is the Australian Health Management Plan for Pandemic Influenza. And when you look at this document and quoting it, there is a worry here. I mean, if Australia was to experience a pandemic as bad as 1918 and Australian government and people were not prepared and unable to respond, a new pandemic could affect 40% of the population in Australia and could kill as many as 2.4% of those affected. So that could be close to 1% of the population, 200,000 people. And interestingly as well, I mean, there's the consequences in terms of, the economics or potential temporary disability, as 50% of the population may not be able to work during the time of the pandemic. And clearly you can imagine that there could be a lot of disruption for a few months if such a pandemic were to occur. Again, don't panic. Luckily, I think the Australian government is planning to respond. And the other scenario they're giving, which is more the optimistic scenario, is that if there was a pandemic as bad as 1918, but we are prepared and we are able to respond, then they've done a revised, more optimistic scenario, which would say instead of 40% of the population, 10% of Australian would catch the virus, be infected by the virus, and the case fatality rates would reduce by 50% to 1.2%, 1.2% mortality rate among those who would be affected. So that would still be around 25,000 people dying from the flu. And again, to put that in comparison with the seasonal flu in Australia is responsible for approximately 2.5 to 3,000 deaths annually. So that would still be a major event. So if we look now more closely at insurance and insurance business, who should be afraid of that risk? So we've talked quickly about, we can think quickly about the liability side, insurance risks. A major pandemic would mean more death or more death claims, potentially more disability, temporary disability claims, medical, and obviously there are also consequences in terms of your capital and the regulatory capital. At other levels, we could be concerned about the market and the economic risks. CEO shareholders might be worried about the share price, the market recession. Your marketing team might be thinking, well, people might be willing to buy more life insurance with that pandemic threat. So causing new business strain as trying to cover people for the risk. And the last one, obviously, very difficult to manage as well, would be the operational risks of potentially having 50% of your, or less or more of your staff not being able to work in a crisis situation. Liability side, I mean, impact on insurance risk, I mean, it seems obvious. We talked about excess mortality, so increasing death claims. And I think the concern for an insurance company perspective would be increasing death claims for the segment of the population aged 20 to 65. Can that be offset by benefits on the longevity side? Maybe, again, depends which age groups are affected by the pandemic. Might not be exactly the same. Obviously, I mean, your mortality book might be more orientated to 20 to 65 years old. Longevity risk would be more for older people. Temporary disability claims increase, of course, potential increase in medical claims. So we've tried to have a brief look at what could be the potential impact on the life insurance industry in terms of additional claims, just focusing on the mortality side in Australia. So roughly looking at the Australian market and potential claims for death, assuming a 50% insurance penetration rate among the 20 to 65 years old population, assuming there would be an average sum assured per life $150,000, and then using the one per mil scenario or one per mil event stress charge from APRA. So one per mil is the 0.5 per mil across 2 years. So, I mean, that scenario would generate an estimated additional death claim of about $1 billion. So is that big? Depends how we look at it. If you compare, that's what we've done on the right side, the last two columns, the amount of the additional death claims versus the annual earnings of the insurance company. So that's the last, the second last column from the right. You can see that the impact in terms of additional death claims of such a scenario would cause, would represent somewhere between 20, 50, 60% of the annual earnings. So it starts to be a major earnings event. Obviously, if you compare this to the annual earnings of potential parent group, especially banking groups, you can see that the impact of the pandemic is relatively much smaller. Regulatory requirements. So indeed, pandemic risk has been a topic in the new LAGIC, with eventually the final event stress, which has been, which is prescribed now, is looking at the impact of a pandemic, which was caused annual mortality of one per mil over 2 years. So again, from what we've seen so far, I mean, the impact of this scenario does not seem that high or not that significant. Of course, will depend on the business mix, but it clearly doesn't seem to be too much of a concern for the industry in terms of from a capital requirement point of view. But beyond that, we believe this is a real risk that can be managed, and if you want to, beyond simple capital consideration. I mean, obviously, beyond the liability risk and the insurance risk, such a pandemic even could have massive impact on the economy and the market risk. I mean, here's an example. It's not pandemic. It's the earthquakes in Japan, 1995, Kobe earthquake, and the Tohoku earthquake in 2011 with the tsunami. And this is, so at time zero was the earthquake happening. You can see the market evolution before and after these events. So you can see that for both these events, I mean, market experienced a sharp decline in immediately after the earthquake and sustainable manner just after. So clearly here, even if the event is local, that was Japan, I mean, there was a global contagion. So I think conclusion here is, major pandemic could first have significant impact on the additional claims insurance companies have to pay, and you can clearly see the impact on the earnings. But more than that, given a potential recession or impact on the markets, you can also question the ability in such a situation of insurance companies to be able to raise capital, for instance, in such circumstances. Thanks. And I will give it to Jan to continue.
So I'm the one that got sick during this research. Actually, I blame it on Melbourne. Actually, it's not sorry if it's from Melbourne. So I flew in and I got sick. I was in Melbourne when that happened. I think, you know, given this is an actuarial event, we've got to talk about the modelling side of it. You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, data in history, and it's sort of saying, well, how do we use it? And how do we, again, look at stress testing the different scenarios going forward, and how do we think about this risk if it evolves? Because, again, I think something that Pierre sort of really highlighted is that, you know, every pandemic can look different, you know, combinations of chicken and pigs. Combination of chickens and pigs and all of that going forward, the next one can be really quite different, you know. So here we go. So Okay, so the modeling overview. Okay, so we love distributions. We love to be able to go, okay, it's going to be gamma. It's going to be, I don't know, inverse gamma. I don't know if that exists, but you know, it's going to be something funky because we love distributions. But we know that there's not enough data points in history to really sort of say, okay, it's going to be a normal distribution or the tail's going to exhibit a fatter tail. There's just not enough reliable statistics, especially when you apply the real side of it. I mean, everything looks different, so you can't look at the attack rate and the fatality rate of, you know, the 1918 and try to do the same for, say, SARS. You know, so now without a reliable statistical sort of distribution, what do? I mean, it's the scenarios, right? So, you know, it's the what-if scenarios. So we're looking at, I guess, how fast people can get this, so the attack rate. We look at once you got it, how deadly it can be. And then we look at in between, you know, things like you might get temporarily sick. Depends on your TSC definitions, you might be temporarily out of work. And if you're longer than the waiting period, you might be on, you know, TSC claims. Or, you know, luck will have it, you'll recover. So that's actually a positive thing. I keep trying to remember that. If you recover, it's a positive thing. So now we look at... So on the left, so the source of that is RMS. On the left, you'd see some of the major pandemics in history. And it's essentially, when you break down the risk, is a combination of how many people it affects, so the attack rate, and how deadly it was. So that's the severity and attack rate that's in the middle. And overlay on top of that, we've got frequency. So how often can it happen? Okay, so there's three major influenza ones. So can you say maybe it's going to be 3%. We start there. Okay? And then the last part is the age group. So that's really your insurance portfolios. So again, we saw some of the pandemics that killed the young people. So touch wood again. But if you're in that situation and you've got a lot of that age group, then you might be more affected than the others. And if you've got the annuity book, you're probably happy. So then we look at these assumptions. So we start with, we've got to start somewhere when we look at scenarios. We can start at the APRA, the minimum pandemic charge. Now, that can be, a combination of 10%, so that's the infection rate, 10% of the people got it, and of these people got it, 1% of them died. So this is the pandemic mortality scenario. But then, again, as actuaries, we have to say, oh, what if we're wrong? What are the scenarios? So what if it's more deadly? So then you move across, move down to the case fatality rate. Or what if it's more contagious but just as deadly? So it's about stress testing your assumptions. I mean, you've got to start somewhere, but then you really do need to stress test it. I think the whole point is, well, potentially you might be right, you might be wrong, but at least you're thinking about it. So who's thought about it? World Health Organization. So they've thought about it. And here are some of their assumptions. So feel free to use this, as part of your day-to-day. And I think what's important to know here is, if you're the view that there's medical as well, clearly this can have higher attack rates. Yeah. Okay, so now this is the, I think we've touched on this before, so I won't sort of go on about it, but I think one of the things we need to, again, sort of stress here is it has to be relevant to your portfolio, so the age group. So it may not always kill the old and the young. So again, the 1918 scenario killed the working population. So we need to allow for that kind of scenario. And then if you love your models, there are models out there. So there's a classic SIR, and then the next one is the enhanced SIR. There's not a lot of difference in the two. I think given time constraints, I'm just going to go into the major difference between the two, actually. I mean, they both look at from the time when you got the disease to potentially what states you can evolve from that disease. Well, the enhanced model you can become infected, you can be hospitalized, you can recover, and boom, you can come back again. Because often we hear a lot in pandemics, it comes in two waves. So again, one scenario is, you know, you've got winter in Oz, somebody took that disease and brought it to London, and somebody on the way back brought it back home. So that's your second wave. So, you know, again, the enhanced SIR looks at what happens if, you know, you recover and then you can come back into the state again. I think we often think about the white swan, but let's not forget about the black swan, but let's not forget about the white swan. The more obvious one, you know, like, because everyone's seen it. I mean, I think, I think quoting APRA will never get me wrong, so I've quoted APRA here. And they refer to this here, one of the other scenarios outside of pandemic is terrorist attacks. It's a real risk. It's something that we've seen actually of late. So it's a terrible tragedy, but beyond that, you know, it affects our day-to-day reserving and, you know, the way we look at risks. Also under Solvency II, they've addressed this as well. As part of the Solvency II, the abnormal mortality sort of charge, they look at the arena scenario and the concentration scenario. So where you've got large amount of people concentrated in one area, and it could be a more, you know, concentrated popular area. And this is more relevant to group portfolios. So how would you go about modeling this? Here we can get really sort of bogged down on what types of attacks. But, you know, I think, again, it's not bogged down on what type of attacks. You know, the variation out there is a lot. But, again, it's about thinking about it. You know, APRA is all about raising risk awareness. So, so my company does a bit of, I'm not advertising here, but I do want to say this is based out on our modeling. And there's all the different types of attacks that can happen under a terrorist sort of scenario. You can get, I guess the more conventional ones are the car bombing. Okay, sorry about the morbidness of this. And often they sort of happen in the more sort of popular tourist areas. And the more, I guess, you've got here like the commercial buildings, office buildings. You've got the public areas like stadiums, nightclubs, cinemas. It can be at, well, the Harbour Bridge, or it can be at the train station. So I guess the first thing we have to think about is where are our portfolio? So, I mean, I hope we've all got the data to say, look, I mean, the best scenario is we've all got postcode data, you know, and then on our retail books you might be able to have that, but do you have the postal address of the work, or do you have it at night? I mean, there's a bit of data challenges to really plot our portfolio, but again, I mean, it's about trying. And if you can't, well, if you don't have access to that, so in particular for the group side of schemes, potentially look at your market share and then use the population data of where everybody is and apply your market share. And the third component of the terrorist modelling is sort of from the centre of attack, so potentially from, say, the Opera House, you know, what is the distance from that attack? And that's going to really determine, you know, injuries such as, you know, whether you're disabled or whether if it's minor cut or whether if unfortunately you die, you know. And so that's the third component. The message here is that the closer you are to the center of attack, the more likely you're going to experience excess mortality. Further, you know, from the attack, disability, and, you know, further from that, you're likely to be safe. And that's just kind of, you know, an example of an attack if it happened in a busy arena. I mean, and I think the starting point is about thinking about it. I mean, we don't have a lot of reliable models. We don't have a lot of statistics. But it's about looking at the scenarios, knowing where your peak accumulations are, and just looking at some of these scenarios. Don't try to scare yourself too much, but at least start thinking about it. So if you're scared of this risk, what are the risk transfer solutions? So how do we mitigate the risk? I think what Pierre talked about earlier was, you know, pandemic, it's more about just excess mortality or excess claims. For the business, it's about business continuity. It's about impact on the share price, you know, and... But I guess some of these risks cannot mitigate. We can try to mitigate a bit, but there's no real risk transfer solutions out there. But where there are, I think is the one that we introduced here today, is about how to reinsure your excess claims. So the most obvious one is the stop loss. So I think we also have a fairly good idea of the stop loss. I mean, so above a level of deductible, reinsurers start to pay you the claims. And if you just want to protect against a pandemic, you can put in a pandemic trigger. And, I mean, this is the comprehensive cover, because anything above a deductible, you're covered, you know, and the deductible could be set, you know, as your historical claims with a bit of buffer, anything above that, very likely it's going to be a pandemic event. And how much would that essentially cost the company? It will be between 2-6%. And I think we've, you know, as real risk managers, we've all tried to explore the stop loss cover out, you know, before. And the first feedback is it's expensive. I want to sort of parallel that to sort of, I guess, prior to 07. I think if somebody said it's going to cost you 150 basis points to cover against the default of, you know, Greece, you think it's too expensive. But then, you know, the Greek bonds, the spreads went to 400, 500 over. So, I mean, it's expensive right now because there's no event. But again, if and when it happens, you're going to think, great, I've got myself protected. I mean, it's that black swan analogy. Just because it can't happen doesn't mean, you know, it won't. Just because you haven't seen it happen, you know. So... there are other, so I won't talk about the stop loss. Everyone knows how it works. We're going to move on to the capital market solutions. So I guess this is about scale. If you're large enough and you need a lot of protection, the other solution out there is capital markets. So, you know, the capital markets is a lot of, it's a lot bigger risk transfer vehicle with a lot of investors. And if that's there, clearly that's the other option. I think everyone would have seen the Swiss Re pandemic bond. So there's not a lot, but that's another option out there if you've got size and scale. And that's the pricing levels. Something I might note here is that you can see a minimum price. I mean, even for bonds that's got almost nothing chance of happening, you know, in relation to a pandemic event, there's still a risk premium of, you know, 2.5%. And that's actually a combination of, well, counterparty risk. That's a combination of relative investment returns, meaning I can invest in a Commonwealth bond and that'll pay me 150, like 1.5%. So a pandemic, if I invest in a pandemic bond, that's going to cost me more, you know. It's a risk-return trade-off. So there is a minimum price for this. That's not actually driven by pandemic risk itself. So, I mean, I think, again, I mean, it's these solutions are out there, but I guess without scale and or the, well, it's still quite expensive to cover. Actually, who else can potentially afford this cover or allow insurance companies to have access to this cover in the event of a pandemic or terrorism? The government, I guess. I mean... they're the ones that's really got the skin in the game. You know, we spend essentially, you know, a lot of money, billions a year on, you know, border control, on, I think the swine flu vaccine, we spent $150 million. A lot of that was actually not used eventually. But, I mean the government's got a social responsibility to keep people safe from these things. So, I mean, if individual insurers are looking to access and want to protect their policyholders and are finding it tough to find this cover, the government should step in and say, look, I will allow you to have access to this and create a pool. Because governments ultimately got the skin in the game. You know, they've got that responsibility. And at the same time, they may allow people that are not insured, which is about, you know, half of our population, maybe even more, to also have some kind of protection in the event that our government's border security, you know, fails, or that in the event we couldn't get enough vaccinated, you know, people vaccinated. So, you know, similar to, I guess, the Medicare levy, for the non-insured, you can tax them as a percentage of an income. And for the insurance companies, it'd be an allocation from your insured premium. And then that will go to a pool, and then allowing that pool to transfer to the bigger global investor base, using, again, the government's counterparty, because, again, they got skin in the game to control and mitigate this risk. So they might be able to access this cover on a more competitive pricing. They're a more credible counterparty as well. So I think ultimately the government do have a role as well. And I think I'm out of time. Thanks, guys. Questions?
Thank you, Anne.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks for taking a seat. Well, you only just beat the bell. Well done. So we've got a couple of minutes for questions. There's some mics back there. If anyone would like to throw a question, please let us know who you are and where you're from, because we're being recorded. I can get one going to start with. You made the point, Pierre, that the pandemics don't affect the same age groups at different times. So I'm looking at that chart of the 1918 flu was quite interesting. We have a lot of the healthy middle-aged lives being affected. Do you have any understanding of, do we have any understanding of why that might have been?
Does it work? Yeah. Again, I'm not an expert at all in medical pandemic, but it's mainly historical evidence. I mean, the H1N1 virus in 1918 affected particularly more significantly that age group, 20 to 30 years old. And I think there could be two explanations at the time. One was that there were people that had been suffering a lot from the war. So clearly, post World War One, they could have been in worse shape. The other thing is why similar viruses could affect mainly younger adults, or again, relatively to the other seasonal flu, is that older people in some cases may already have immunity to the virus from similar virus like. That could have happened 30, 40 years ago, whereas the young adults don't have that immunity.
Mm. Okay, a couple of good potential answers there. Thank you. Okay.
X from APRA. You put up some figures looking at what would happen to the life insurance industry under various scenarios, but you looked predominantly at the direct insurance market. You didn't look or didn't show any figures that looked what might happen to the reinsurance sector. Did you do any examination of that? Because one of the biggest risks that probably exists would be a failure of reinsurance and then the impact back onto the direct insurance sector.
Hello. Yep. You're right. No, we didn't. And I think that's probably definitely one of the weaknesses in this. However, that being said, I think the reinsurers often retro some of their local business back to the parent company. And they may, if I were to do that, if we were to do that again, it should be done on a wider scale. But you're right, yes. And actually, where we should have probably also done is to look at the, you know, who are the major group players and who are the more retail players as well. You're right.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Since contrary to the insurance companies, so insurance companies will have mortality, morbidity risk, but they do have a lot of investment risk. Reinsurers, on the other side, tend to have, when they're very strong on the life side, tend not to have investment risk as much as life insurance companies. So reinsurers are very much more exposed to a pandemic than life insurance company. The difficulty here is it's a bit more difficult to get the numbers and really evaluate the exposure to reinsurers, because they may be writing proportional reinsurance, non-proportional reinsurance, but for sure, I guess all the major reinsurers are looking at pandemic risk as major threats on their own solvency. As far as I know, most of the reinsurers, the big players, have been trying in one way or another to transfer part of this extreme risk.
Yeah, and also back at the parent level, they may have business mix. I think other than one life reinsurer here, the rest will be, got a mix of casualty business as well as the life business. So, but yeah, you should probably take that into account too. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think sadly we're out of time. So my last two tasks. One is to ask you to please fill out your feedback forms and leave them at the door on the way out, I think. And also my last task is to present a token of thanks to both of our speakers.